You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. During the holidays, we often focus on the joy and the celebrations, but this can be a very difficult time. Some people are grieving the loss of a loved one, or perhaps living in financial turmoil. Do you feel sadness, depression, or anxiety this time of year? Have you always felt holiday sadness? Why? What strategies do you use to cope? Share your situation, share what helps at 800-642-1234. We have clinical psychologists to guide our conversation. But first, livestock odors. You know when you drive by a large hog farm and catch just a whiff, you think, you know, this too shall pass. But what if you live near these intense smells and you can't get away from them? For regulators, measuring rotten odors is tricky. Yasik Kojil is a professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering at Iowa State University. In shorthand here, he's a livestock odor researcher, and WPR host Keely Baltina talked with him about the science of smells.
When we say that we smell something, what does that really mean? What's going on?
Well, that's a loaded question. Excellent question right there. So, you know, sense of smell is one of those things that we learn a lot. We don't know much still yet about it. So, you know, just about 15 years ago, a Nobel Prize was awarded for actually unlocking why we smell, why human and how human nose processes smells. So there is still a lot of research to be done. So we are dealing with a lot of, you know, fundamental science, but a lot of unknown things with psychology, sociology, etc.
Can scientists really then objectively measure how strong an odor is?
We try to do that. So we developed tools. They aren't perfect, but we have kind of two ways of doing this. One of them is basically take a big, like a big Ziploc type bag of odorous air and dilute this with pure air and present to, in a blind test, present it to a series of panelists, trained panelists, that basically try to detect the difference between odorless air and air that is injected with tiny portions of the odor that we try to analyze.
So you're training real human beings to do this and detect the smell.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, that sort of technique doesn't get into what really is in that odor. It goes after how does this odor smell, how strong it is, how an average person represented by these trained panelists is actually reacting to something in the air that is not just pure smellless air. So that's one way of doing this. But there is, you know, there is another one where we can actually analyze those molecules, various molecules in the air, and then connect that sense of smell that we have simultaneously with those analytical tools. So we, in essence, we are able to find sort of the needles in the haystack, if you will. But they are buried, you know, in this, you know, this massive mixture of thousands of different compounds. And not all of them contribute, only typically several few that makes us experience an odor or maybe some nice aroma.
Yeah, well, one of those is a smell that can be associated with farm animals. This is Wisconsin, especially when they're large operations. What are some of the compounds that occur there that we would identify with unpleasant smells?
So there is several of them. We identified through that process I described before, the simultaneous chemical and sensory analysis, handful of compounds that we would really want to eliminate. And some of those would be phenolic compounds. Those are the kinds of chemicals that, tiny little amount in the air is very noticeable. Another class of compounds is volatile fatty acids, and then probably hydrogen sulfide. So perhaps a handful of compounds that we always detect when we work with livestock waste, ambient air in and around these facilities. They are always there.
Jacek Kozel is a professor of agricultural and biosystems engineering at Iowa State University. He's a livestock odor researcher. And Jacek, if it only takes a little bit of these compounds in the air to create that unpleasant smell, I sense it could get really overwhelming very quickly. How can we figure out the level of that? I mean, do we have tools that we can figure out to lessen the impact on people near these livestock situations?
Well, that's a great question. That's what we engineers here at Ag Engineering at Iowa State University and colleagues all around the country work on, engineering ways of mitigating odor, not necessarily right at the farm, but the odor that might be experienced by neighbors. So we start with the assumption that there will be always manure or other sources of odor. And we try to apply something or develop some tools that will be one feasible for farm applications. Number two, they will fit in sort of socio economic situation at a particular farm. So, that means money, that means technology. We are very very concerned that whatever we develop and test is actually farm tested. And I should say there are probably many technologies that are actually proven to work, but they have been developed for industrial applications, for different types of industries, for much bigger level of funding that these industries have. That's not necessarily the case with many of the farmers.
As an engineer, briefly, what do you think that policymakers should take into consideration as they're deciding whether they're strengthening or loosening regulations around large-scale animal facilities?
Again, this is a loaded question, but I would say that we need all of the stakeholders at the table, meaning, and I know that some of the counties, for example, do that they try to not to make haste decisions that drive an issue in one direction or another. They are very careful about involving all of the stakeholders around this issue from the very beginning. We need to actually do quite a bit more work to understand, probably from political angle too, that this is a multi-level, multi-disciplinary, if you will, issue.
Jacek, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was WPR host Keely Baltina with Iowa State livestock odor researcher Jacek Kozel. Find more at wiscontext.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Back. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So let's talk about adult friendship here. And just to get it out there, friendship is hard, it's awkward, and we should just accept that. So here's a tip. Don't go into every situation looking for a best friend. You put too much pressure on yourself. But your next close friend might just be a stranger to you right now, and people like you more than you think they do. Researchers call this quote, the liking gap. We're learning about this gap with NPR reporter Julia Furlan. She put together a guide on friendship for the NPR series Life Kit. How do you feel out those loose acquaintances to see if there could be something there as a friend?
You know, I think that you it's a little bit tricky because you don't want to come in too hot. You know, you don't want to make people uncomfortable. And I should say that, like, you know, this doesn't mean that every service worker that you interact with needs to be your best friend. But if you are walking through the world and interacting with people as you do, just taking a moment to notice that those tiny interactions and make them a little bit more personable instead of just sort of going into robot mode or, like, you know, honestly, maybe instead of using the app of your Starbucks app, you actually wait in line and talk to the barista for a second. That kind of tiny shift in the intention behind these conversations can sort of change them. Jillian Sandstrom is the researcher I was talking to, and Jillian basically tested this out with the two control groups and found that people who had a small interaction with what she calls weak ties, people who are, you know, who you see in the world, who you have a jaunty exchange with, maybe you share a joke, you complain about the weather, whatever it is, people who do that feel less lonely. They feel better in their lives than people who are sort of like blinders on, move through the world, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that sometimes we forget that that's part of it. You know, sometimes we forget that that weak tie can happen. I have a really good friend that I made because I was going to this, you know, I'm not a very good cook, but it was like my night to do dinner. So I would go to this one restaurant every Tuesday, and I would just talk to the chef who was, you know, behind the counter and blah, blah, blah. And now it's like 6 years later, and I'm really good friends with her and her husband and her two kids, and I feel a genuine closeness. But it you know, you have to respect the time that it might take to constantly, you know, go to the same place.
I had this aha moment when you talked about someone who had asked their hairstylist, do you cut the hair of anyone who I might be, you know, someone who I could hit it off with, perhaps a friend? You know, that was very resourceful.
I love that story. Yeah, it's basically a story of a listener who called in, who Cassidy, I think her name was Cassidy. Forgive me if I'm wrong. Oh, God, what a terrible thing. But she basically she had just moved to a new city. She had green hair and was going to get her hair touched up, and just asked her hairdresser, hey, do you know anyone else who you think I would just vibe with as a friend? And the hairdresser had a moment and thought and thought and thought, and then set Cassidy up on a friendship blind date. And Cassidy has green hair, and the blind date had pink hair. And they, you know, they hit it off. They, like, became friends and went to coffee and ended up going, I think, getting wine or something like that. So I think that asking around and being vulnerable in that way, being sort of direct and saying, hey, I'm new here, or hey, I'm looking to make new friends. Do you know anyone that you think I would vibe with? That's a pretty good start.
Another tip that you have is to be present with our friends, to remember things, to take notes.
Yes.
Help us out in keeping our friends organized and checking in with them.
Yeah, I think that changing a little, it's really about intention. It's about saying, like, instead of sort of like going on the usual path of yeah, how are you? How are your kids? Blah, blah, blah. Sitting and sort of like listening to somebody as they share about it and asking like follow-up questions can be a really interesting way to sort of break out of your usual friendship conversation or patterns. And taking notes is incredible. I have my friend Thibaut. He started basically making a list of topics that we were going to talk about that he wanted to ask me about. And listen, it's not for everyone.
It sounds like an agenda.
It is, but it really helped. It made me feel he was like updating me on his life. A lot was going on, and it like kept him on track, and it made it so that he could sort of let go of wondering like, oh, I wanted to say that one thing, but we didn't get to talk about it. It made it so that he could go through his agenda of like all of his updates on me, and we could really have like a structure for the conversation. I think that people should work to be present in that way, and whatever that means for you, you know, like it doesn't have to mean taking notes. It can mean, you know, writing down your friend's birthday in Google Calendar, and making sure that you maybe instead of sending them a Facebook message or a text message, you actually pick up the phone and call them on their birthday. That kind of like small intention that increases, maybe it increases a little bit of your vulnerability, but it also increases the attention that you're giving to them is really helpful.
Yeah, we're learning about friendship in adulthood with NPR reporter Julia Furlan. You can join in. Did you make some of your best friends later in life? Why do you think it worked out that way? 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Julia, you talk about the friendship triangle. It has three sides to figure out, you know, what's going on if a friendship is feeling off, it's not working. Mm-hmm. What is the friendship triangle?
Okay, I love this concept. I think everyone should sort of like put it in their minds. If you're listening here, just like picture a triangle that has three sides all equal. It's a concept from a writer named Shasta Nelson, who has a really great book called Frentimacy that I recommend, and also TED Talks if a book is not your thing. I mean, it should be, but you know, it's fine. Anyway, so you're picturing a triangle here, right? The base of the triangle is positivity. And that doesn't necessarily mean that your relationship with that person is like inherently all good times all the time. It means that when you think about that person or when you're with that person, you come away with a sense of positivity more often than you come away with a sense of like negativity, you know? And then the other two sides of the triangle are consistency, which is like how frequently you see that friend and how frequently you interact with them, and vulnerability. And basically, Shasta Nelson says that consistency and vulnerability should increase at the same rate. So like if you see someone every single day and you're wanting to like be more of a friend with them. I mean, I feel like every day is a lot for a new friend. But like, you know, let's say you see somebody like a couple times a week or whatever. Your consistency in seeing them should increase at the same rate of vulnerability. So like you shouldn't be overly vulnerable with somebody who you don't see or interact with that consistently, you know?
Right.
And then the positivity is the base because it sort of informs the other two interactions. Like, you know, not every time you talk to a friend do you come away with that sort of like warm, full feeling. I mean, hopefully all as much as possible, but not always. But the idea is that like overwhelmingly you have a positive vibe or a positive feeling when you're with them. Yeah, so that's the friendship triangle. Positivity, consistency, and vulnerability.
Well, let's squeeze in a call now. Dan is joining us from Drummond. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Well, what I want to suggest is become a volunteer. I mean, maybe you won't make a lot of friends, but you'll make a lot of acquaintances. And for myself, years ago, when my hometown of Mellon had a nursing home open up, one of the ladies that I met had a special history. She grew up in the Dakotas. She turned out to be one of Lawrence Welk's first piano players on radio.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's so much history that is lost, and it's just take the time to go and visit with someone.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. Being a volunteer is, you know, you have that potential to make friends, Julia, but also you're doing something really good.
Absolutely, Dan. That is a wonderful idea, especially because, you know, if you follow the things that you're passionate about, you will find a way to volunteer. You can fit that into your life if that fits into your schedule. And, you know, do you like cooking? Is there a book club? Look at the communities that you're already a part of and see if doing a little bit of good is gonna open up that friendship thing. And I think, you know, Dan used the word acquaintance, but like, you know, you could also, if you're consistent going to volunteer at that one place, your acquaintance from volunteering could eventually become like a really lifelong friend.
Julia, let's talk for a moment here about when people change and friendships change, and sometimes friendships start to fade away. How yeah. should we treat that time?
You know, I think that there's a really solid script in place that says that, you know, you make a friend when you're five, and then that person is your friend forever, and they have to be in your wedding, and then you have to, like, raise your kids together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I am here to say that, like, not every single friendship that you have is going to last your entire life. And I think that that is something that is a little bit different. I think that we want to be loyal people. We want to show up for our friends. But I do feel as if we would serve ourselves well by sitting down and evaluating the people that we have in our lives and realizing that, like, not all the time do we need to carry somebody's friendship. We can be grateful for them and sort of, you know, let them go if the friendship is, like, damaging or not serving us in the way that it should.
You're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we are traveling around the state exploring band shells, those outdoor performance spaces that are typically used by concert bands and orchestras. The roof and the back half give musicians that cover from the elements, and then they project sound through the open side and out toward the audience. And band stands are a smaller version of that. What questions do you have about band shells in Wisconsin? Are you curious about one in your city or one that you visited? Are you a musician or another artist who has performed at a band shell? What do you think about these venues? Do you have a favorite one? Join in at 800-642-1234. Marjorie Kozich is the creator of a website that chronicles more than 100 band shells and bandstands across Wisconsin. Marjorie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. I really am excited about being here and talking about it.
So you've been building this collection of band shell photos and history for about 15 years. How did you get started?
Well, it wasn't exactly an aha moment, but one time we were traveling in Minneapolis, and we happened upon Lake Harriet, which has a gorgeous band shell there. It's not that old, or for me, it's not that old. It's not like a 1900s one, but it's a beautiful one. I thought, oh my gosh, there must be plenty of them in Wisconsin. And I started noticing them a lot more. And then I was taking photos. And then I thought, oh, well, I'll have to find out more about them, when they were built, who built them, how were they built, who is the architect, all that kind of information.
And they have so much history. Each one has a unique story. It was funny, last night I was scrounging around for pictures. I wanted to show you a picture of myself at the Lake Harriet band shell. It was my neighborhood. And I mean, I just remember the smell of the popcorn and the crushed gravel under your feet. And then, like, when there wasn't a concert going on, kids would hoist themselves up on the stage and then pretend to perform.
Absolutely. I have my grandchildren. We were at one with my granddaughters one time, and they put on a performance for us. So
yeah,
it was really fun to watch.
Really neat. So you retired and started working on this project. Did you previously work in music or architecture? No, I didn't.
I worked for WIDA, which is Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, and I worked in the multifamily housing where we developed housing for low and moderate income families.
So by the numbers, how many band shells does Wisconsin have? Do we have any number out there?
Well, on my count, I have 120. I have about three more that are in process of being built. I just discovered a few more this week, actually, by looking. I thought, I wonder if Nina has one. I wonder if Menasha has one. Well, I didn't see one there, and they may have one, but I found one in Kimberly, and I found another one in Green Bay at the Olbrich Gardens, or not the, their Olbrich their, Gardens, uh-huh. yes, yeah. their botanical gardens.
What are some of your favorites?
Well, you know the song, you love the one you're with. So I think they're all really charming and very delightful, and the communities they're located in really love them. They really take a great pride in them. When I wrote emails to ask about information about them, there were great responses. They didn't take a long time, and people are just love to talk about them.
What are your favorite ones around where you live in your neighborhood?
Well, they're in South Central Wisconsin, where I'm located. Lake Mills is a really charming one. They have a square there, and they just renovated it. Wanakee has a really nice one. Belleville. Janesville has a great one at the bottom of their courthouse. It's called Courthouse Square, I believe, or something similar to that.
Yeah. Do you find that these band shells have similar characteristics in terms of like seating, for instance? A lot of park benches, or, you know, what are some of the common threads?
Some have park benches, but mostly it's a grassy area. People bring their chairs and they set them up and listen to it.
Yeah. We're exploring the stories behind Wisconsin band shells with Marge Kozich. She is the creator of a website that chronicles more than 100 band shells around the state. And you can join in. Do you have a band shell in your neighborhood, in your community? What can you tell us about it? Why was it built and how is it used today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Marge, where can people usually find band shells?
The public parks are the mostly where they are located, and there are in the they can be in the near rivers or lakes or streams. Centrally located, there's a gorgeous one in Wausau that it took them quite a long time to get there, but it's a beautiful one, and that square in downtown Wausau hosts many events, and they use the band shell that's there.
What makes it the one in Wausau so beautiful to you?
It has a roof that's a flying canopy. It's a tensile fabric that they've used. And there's another one that has a fabric canopy also. It's in Two Rivers, right on Lake Michigan at Neshota Park. I've just found that one this year, so I don't have a lot of information about it yet.
So even the materials of band shells can be widely different.
Right, exactly.
You know, from that material to the Art Deco one in Milwaukee,
yes,
which is, you know, very, very sturdy.
Yes, and that one, Emil Blatt's Temple of Music. And it was created in the 1930s, and Emil Blatt's donated $100,000 at the time, and he's from the Blatt's Beer Company, if people don't recognize that. And they had major talent come to that band shell at that time, and it was broadcast on CBS and I think ABC Radio nationally. So that is a very unique one in our state.
How are these band shells funded?
Some of the early ones were funded by WPA funds, Works Product Administration, and mm-hmm. that was during the Depression when Roosevelt was trying to get things going and the economy
back
better.
Work.
So
yeah.
In Southeast Wisconsin, there's quite a few that are like that. Others have had major donors, such as the Emil Blatt's in Milwaukee. Mm.
Let's take a call now. Tom joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
We have a beautiful band shell here in Burlington, Wisconsin, in Veterans Park. And they're really beautiful. What I'm talking about. But anyway, I wrote a song called Mother Liberty. It's for the 9/11. It memorializes the 9/11 tragedy. And anyway, we're going to play the song last year on Memorial Day. So we got up there and everything was all set up. And then the CN, the Canadian National, which goes all the way through Wisconsin, we have one that comes right through town here. Well, the trains came through town. The train came through town, so we had the mayor and Robin Voss and all the dignitaries were all sitting there on the bench, and we're all sitting around, and we had to stop the song for about 5 minutes till the train came through town. And then, but if people want to hear the song, it's called Tom Boyle, Mother Liberty, and they can Google it because it's now on the internet.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate you joining in with your band shell in Burlington, and it sounds like you have to deal with those natural elements, whether it's a train or rain. That's just part of the outdoors.
Right, and thanks, Tom, because I didn't know about that one. I'll have to visit Burlington now.
So you visited a band shell in Manitowoc with an interesting history that stretches back to World War II. Can you tell us about it?
That band shell was built in the 90s, the current one. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, the gentleman who was the band director had worked at the building the submarines in Manitowoc. And he had a band there that every time they had a dedication that they would play for it or a launch. And he always wanted a band shell there. And he had many fundraisers. They never seemed to get to the top where you'd have enough funding to do it. Finally, they had a temporary bandstand at our band shell that they used. And it wasn't until after he died that the city were able to build a bandstand, and it is honoring his name.
So, Marjorie, how do you go about collecting all this information? You might have a dozen photos of a band shell on a specific entry, but where do you find the history?
Well, I look up who is director of the parks, and I send them an email, and I have a standard list of questions I ask them. When was it built? Who built it? What was the cost? How was it funded? What are the interesting stories about it? And can you share all this with me? So I do the city parks directors. I will also use the local historical societies. And I will also use if a Rotary or a Kiwanis or a service club has been involved in it, I will contact them. I will also contact the libraries, too, because they are a very good resource for newspaper articles. If I have a date that I can give them, they will look it up and check it out with me.
Yeah, so there is a lot of detective work in order to find out how these band shells came to be.
Right.
Do you find that they're well-maintained?
Usually they are, because everybody loves them. And there's so many performances that they put on during the summer, usually once a week, sometimes twice a week. Because they do have community bands that play there, and then they also have other local talent that they bring in to play.
We're exploring band shells around Wisconsin with the help of Marge Kozich. She has chronicled more than 100 band shells in our state, and she's sharing them on her website. What do you think makes a great band shell? Does it need a roof or a colorful design? Do you prefer lighting or a natural scene? Join in with your remembrances, your questions, 800-642-1234. Email about your band shell ideas at WPR.org. Back for more Wisconsin Weekend in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is full of band shells, and we're learning about their history on Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee is home, as we had said earlier, to the Emil Blatz Temple of Music, located in Washington Park. It's an Art Deco-style curved band shell dating back to its dedication 81 years ago this month. And the short, thick columns that bookend the band shell are adorned with Greek muses, and the park bench seating can fit up to 8,000 people. It's just one of the band shells documented by Marjorie Kozich, and she has about a dozen pictures of this one entry. Her website chronicles more than 100 band shells all over the state. Does your community have a band shell for festivals and concerts? What can you tell us about it? What does it look like? Why was it built? How is it used today? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Marge Kozich stays with us. So as we look at band shell design, can you talk about the acoustics and how they work?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I have seen a couple where it's been a real highlight of them. And one is in Elkhorn, Wisconsin at Sunset Park. And it's a Sunset Park banjo, as you can guess. It's on the National Register of Historic Places. It was built in 1926, and it was designed by a person from Phoenix, Arizona. It was considered one of the finest.
Why was it considered one of the finest? What made it stand out?
Because of its acoustical qualities, and it incorporated thousands of 1 foot by 1 inch wooden slats. And it's only one of two of its kind known in existence in the U.S. today. I don't know what the other one is. I've tried to find that out, but I don't know.
There's also one in Siren that you really like.
Yes, that one is actually, it's made out of logs that were harvested from the forest in the area.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's local materials.
It is, yes. It's a very, very stunning. It's near a lake, of course. It's in a county park. It's Crooked Lake Bandshell.
Do you find that communities are still building bandshells, still remodeling them? Are they still part of our...
Yes, there's a lot of activity going on. One of the biggest ones in the state, I think, that's very interesting right now is in La Crosse. And it was built in the 1920s. Wendell Anderson was a physician in La Crosse, and he funded it. It's very Art Deco in style. It didn't have a canopy, so it was like mostly cement and design. Now it's in the process of being remodeled by the city of La Crosse, and they're putting in over $1 million to redo it. It's being redone right now. I'm not sure if that part is finished yet. Several bands that used it also wanted a canopy on it, and so they formed a nonprofit, and they're raising over $800,000 to do that. And I think that'll be done by next spring. So it'll be interesting to see how it all comes together.
You talk with people from all walks of life, from all over. Are people enthusiastic about their local bandshell?
Oh, absolutely. They really enjoy them. They support them. They come to all the concerts. And I would say most of the concerts are free also to the public. So they're a real... heart of the community, and people just love to go to them.
Do you intend to keep building your website, building it out more banjos?
Well, as I said, I have three more to add, and two of them are local. One's in Mazomanie, which is going to have their groundbreaking in late August, I believe. And that one is designed by the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture as a community service, I believe. So, Mazomanie is a very small community, and it'll be nice to see it. The other one is in my hometown, Middleton, which they're building a park downtown, and I haven't heard lately what's happening, but I'm sure it's going to be very interesting to see how it all comes together.
Well, Marjorie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Marjorie Kozich is the creator of a website that chronicles more than 100 bandshells and stands across Wisconsin. You can find a link to her website in our program notes on WPR.org. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about someone who draws under the radar.
On a recent summer afternoon, Nishant Jen, also known as the Sneaky Artist, sat down in an Eau Claire park. In front of him, couples reclined on the grass and split fish tacos. Three children passed a sticky bottle of orange soda back and forth. Dogs sniffed curiously at each other. Jen uncapped his pen and began to draw.
There's a lot of beautiful things all around us. Sneaky art is my way of appreciating beauty in these ordinary things, like today here, an ordinary place and ordinary people living ordinary lives. But I feel like I've learned this from watching them and from trying to make art of it, is that even in these ordinary lives, all of us, like, we're locked in these moments of just accidental beauty, not something that was planned, but something that's just there, and in the way they're standing, in the way they're talking to each other. I think it's my duty to record that art. My name is Nishant Jain. Well, I've been drawing all my life, I feel, but I really started doing this as a means of learning how to draw better. I used to draw stick figures. This is 2015. Just the circle with four lines for the arms and one for the body. That's it. And that was the extent of my drawing ability. But I wanted to learn how to draw better. So since 2015, 2016, I put myself through this regimen where I walk around wherever I live, whichever town I'm in, and I walk around and I try to draw everything I see as a means of learning how to draw. I grew up in a city of the city of Calcutta in India, in the East. Very regular Indian life. And I studied engineering in my undergrad, as a lot of people of my generation did. That was the most standard education to get because it guaranteed you a job. I was about 2 years into my PhD program, halfway through, when it just struck me that I'm wasting too much time. I'm trying to get a degree that I don't really care for, that if left to me entirely, I would not pursue further. So that's when I decided that I was going to quit. I credit that to the US a lot, seeing the people here and the way they chase after their passions. That really gave me the courage to do the same. When I draw people and I look at them, a lot of these people are very, very alien to me, and I can't even imagine how alien I am to them. But the act of drawing them, although it doesn't work reciprocally, but it does bring me a lot closer to them, in a sense. And I appreciate that fact. It makes it easier for me to be out here. Even though I don't know anybody, I feel friendlier towards them. Even though it's not my town, it's not my countryside, it's not my part of the world in any sense, I feel like having drawn all the lines of all the things over here, and those lampposts a dozen and a hundred times, in a way I can feel like this, I understand it. It can be more homely. Seeing the world through different people's eyes helps you appreciate a lot of the things that you take for granted. And that's what I want people who enjoy my art to feel.
That was Nishant Jain, the sneaky artist based in Eau Claire. His story came to us from Clara Napert, an intern at WPR's Eau Claire office. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every single Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. What's happening in your part of the state that could reach all corners of Wisconsin? Send your ideas for Wisconsin Weekend. We would love them. Go to mornings@wpr.org. That's mornings@wpr.org, and we'll explore your tip for a Wisconsin Weekend program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is Wisconsin Weekend on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.